what it wants to do. Some of the methods are compatible, while others represent mutually exclusive alternatives. In this chapter, we canvass the main options. In the next four chapters, we will explore some of the key issues at greater depth. It is important to realize that some control method, or combination of methods, must be implemented before the system becomes superintelligent. It cannot be done after the system has obtained a decisive strategic advantage. The need to solve the control problem in advance, and to implement the solution successfully in the very first system to attain superintelligence, is part of what makes achieving a controlled detonation such a daunting challenge. Capability control methods. Capability control methods seek to prevent undesirable outcomes by limiting what the superintelligence can do. This might involve placing the superintelligence in an environment in which it is unable to cause harm, boxing methods, or in which there are strongly convergent instrumental reasons not to engage in harmful behavior, incentive methods. It might also involve limiting the internal capacities of the superintelligence, stunting. In addition, capability control methods might involve the use of mechanisms to automatically detect and react to various kinds of containment failure or attempted transgression, tripwires. Boxing methods. Boxing methods can be subdivided into physical and informational containment methods. Physical containment aims to confine the system to a box, i.e., to prevent the system from interacting with the external world otherwise than via specific, restricted output channels. The boxed system would not have access to physical manipulators outside of the box. Removing manipulators, such as robotic arms, from inside the box as well would prevent the system from constructing physical devices that could breach the confinement. For extra security, the system should be placed in a metal mesh to prevent it from transmitting radio signals, which might otherwise offer a means of manipulating electronic objects, such as radio receivers, in the environment. Note, by the way, how easy it might have been to overlook the need for this precaution. One might naively have assumed that an agent without a manipulator could not affect the external world. But it might be possible for a machine intelligence to generate radio waves even when it lacks access to external manipulators, simply by thinking, that is, by shuffling the electrons in its circuitry in particular patterns. Once pointed out, this vulnerability can be patched by enclosing the system in a Faraday cage, but we are left wondering how many other, similarly subtle vulnerabilities might exist. Each time we hear of a seemingly foolproof security design that has an unexpected flaw, we should prick up our ears. These occasions grace us with the opportunity to abandon a life of overconfidence and resolve to become better Bayesians. Physical confinement has several advantages. It is easy to implement. It can be applied to many machine intelligence architectures, even ones that were not initially designed with safety as an objective. It can be used in combination with most other control methods, and it seems unlikely to go wrong by backfiring. That is, while it might fail to ensure safety, it is unlikely to cause a catastrophe that would not otherwise have occurred. The main disadvantage with physical confinement is that it reduces the functionality of the superintelligence, an issue to which we will return in Chapter 10. Another concern is that it might encourage a false sense of security, though this is avoidable if we regard physical confinement as icing on the cake, rather than the main substance of our precautions. Informational containment aims to restrict what information is allowed to exit the box. We have already seen how a superintelligence that has access to an internet port, such that it can message outside entities, is potentially unsafe. Even if it starts out with access to physical actuators, it may use its information output channel to get human beings to do its bidding. An obvious informational containment method, therefore, is to bar the system from accessing communications networks. Uploading an AI from the internet does not, however, ensure safety if there are one or more humans serving as the system's gatekeepers and remaining in communication with it. During the development phase, the programmers serve as gatekeepers. During the operational phase, the system's owner might play this role. If the AI can persuade or trick a gatekeeper to let it out of the box, resulting in its gaining access either to the internet or directly to physical manipulators, then the boxing strategy has failed. Human beings are not secure systems, especially not when pitched against a superintelligent schemer and persuader. Although routing the outbound communications of a machine intelligence to a human gatekeeper does not guarantee safety, it could serve as an auxiliary safety measure. There are precautions that might reduce the risk of the AI escaping through the gatekeeper. The AI could be allowed to communicate only via a low-bandwidth teletype interface. This would make it slightly harder to psychologically manipulate the gatekeepers, precluding the use of emotive sound and imagery, and tricks such as flashing hypnotic patterns to induce a trance-like state. Going further, the content, not just the mode presentation of the output, could be restricted, so that, for example, the AI would be constrained to giving single-bit answers to yes/no questions. The idea of building a question-answering system will be examined further in the next chapter. The limiting case of the boxing approach would be a system kept in complete physical and informational isolation. Even if achievable, however, such an isolated system would be rather useless, since it would have no effect on the external world. It might perhaps be thought that some scientific purpose could be served by creating a superintelligence and keeping it in isolation. By studying a self-contained model system, one could learn about its internal dynamics and its behavior patterns. But this would be an error. As soon as the system is observed, it ceases to be informationally isolated. Information can be transmitted not only via messages that an AI sends out through a designated output channel, but also via any observation an outsider makes of some causal consequence of the AI's workings, direct or indirect. Its power consumption, its CPU and memory usage, its computational states, or indeed any traces left behind after it has been shut down. An AI, anticipating that it might be observed in any of these ways, could strategically adopt behaviors designed to influence the hypothesized observers. For example, the AI could malfunction in whichever way would most increase the probability that it will ultimately be reactivated, or that another superintelligence will be created with goals similar to its own. Incentive methods. Incentive methods involve placing an agent in an environment where it finds instrumental reasons to act in ways that promote the principal's interests. Consider a billionaire who uses her fortune to set up a large charitable foundation. Once created, the foundation may be powerful, more powerful than most individuals, including its founder, who might have donated most of her wealth. To control the foundation, the founder lays down its purpose in articles of incorporation and bylaws, and appoints a board of directors sympathetic to her cause. These measures constitute a form of motivation selection, since they aim to shape the foundation's preferences. But even if such attempts to customize the organizational internals fail, the foundation's behavior would remain circumscribed by its social and legal milieu. The foundation would have an incentive to obey the law, for example, lest it be shut down or fined. It would have an incentive to offer its employees acceptable pay and working conditions, and to satisfy external stakeholders. Whatever its final goals, the foundation thus has instrumental reasons to conform its behavior to various social norms. Might one not hope that a machine superintelligence would likewise be hemmed in by the need to get along with the other actors with which it shares the stage? Though this might seem like a straightforward way of dealing with the control problem, it is not free of obstacles. In particular, it presupposes a balance of power. Legal or economic sanctions cannot restrain an agent that has a decisive strategic advantage. Social integration can therefore not be relied upon as a control method in fast or medium takeoff scenarios that feature a winner-takes-all dynamic. How about in multipolar scenarios, wherein several agencies emerge post-transition with comparable levels of capability? Unless the default trajectory is one with a slow takeoff, achieving such a power distribution may require a carefully orchestrated ascent, wherein different projects are deliberately synchronized to prevent any one of them from ever pulling ahead of the pack. Even if a multipolar outcome does result, social integration is not a perfect solution. By relying on social integration to solve the control problem, the principal risks sacrificing a large portion of her potential influence. Although a balance of power might prevent a particular AI from taking over the world, that AI will still have some power to affect outcomes. And if that power is used to promote some arbitrary final goal, maximizing paperclip production, it is probably not being used to advance the interests of the principal. Imagine our billionaire endowing a new foundation and allowing its mission to be set by a random word generator. Not a species-level threat, but surely a wasted opportunity. A related but importantly different idea is that an AI, by interacting freely in society, would acquire new human-friendly final goals. Some such process of socialization takes place in us humans. We internalize norms and ideologies, and we come to value other individuals for their own sakes in consequence of our experiences with them. But this is not a universal dynamic present in all intelligent systems. As discussed earlier, many types of agent in many situations will have convergent instrumental reasons not to permit changes in their final goals. One might consider trying to design a special kind of goal system that can acquire final goals in the manner that humans do, but this would not count as a capability control method. We will discuss some possible methods of value acquisition in Chapter 12. Capability control through social integration and balance of power relies upon diffuse social forces rewarding and penalizing the AI. Another type of incentive method would involve creating a setup wherein the AI can be rewarded and penalized by the project that creates it, and thereby incentivized to act in the interests of the principal. To achieve this, the AI would be placed in a surveillance context that allows its behavior to be monitored and evaluated, either manually or by some automated process. The AI would know that a positive evaluation would bring about some outcome it desires, and that a negative evaluation would fail to do so. Theoretically, the reward could be the fulfillment of some convergent instrumental goal. Without knowing anything specific about the AI's motivation system, however, it might be difficult to calibrate the reward mechanism. For example, we could end up with an AI that would be willing to take extreme risks for the sake of a small chance of eventually obtaining control of a large share of the universe. It could be expensive to offer the AI a higher expected utility as reward for cooperation than the AI could hope to achieve by defecting and trying to escape. A better alternative might be to combine the incentive method with the use of motivation selection to give the AI a final goal that makes it easier to control. Suppose that an AI were designed to have as its final goal that a particular red button inside a command bunker never be pressed. Since the pressing of the button is disvalued intrinsically and not because of its causal consequences, the button could be completely inert. It could be made of Play-Doh. Furthermore, it is irrelevant whether the AI can ever know whether the button had been pressed. What is essential is that the AI believes that the button will more likely remain unpressed if the AI continuously acts in the principal's interest than if it rebels. Refinements to this setup are possible. Instead of trying to endow an AI with a final goal that refers to a physical button, one could build an AI that places final value on receiving a stream of cryptographic reward tokens. These would be sequences of numbers serving as keys to ciphers that would have been generated before the AI was created, and that would have been built into its motivation system. These special number sequences would be extremely desirable to the AI, constituting a special kind of reward token that the AI could not attain, though wireheading. The keys would be stored in a secure location, where they could be quickly destroyed if the AI ever made an attempt to seize them. So long as the AI cooperates, the keys are doled out at a steady rate. The AI could then be given a bounded utility function, and matters could be arranged so that the AI would get, for instance, 99% of its maximum utility from the first reward token, 99% of its remaining utility potential from the second reward token, and so on. By keeping the discount rate high, and by transmitting reward tokens to the AI at a reasonably high rate, one would dissuade the AI from attempting to carry out long-term plans that would increase the expected number of reward tokens in the distal future at the expense of some risk that its reward stream will be cut short, or that the next reward token will be cancelled and destroyed. If the AI also believes that defecting, i.e., doing anything other than its best to look after the principal's interests, would incur at least a 2% risk of forfeiting the next reward token, whereas cooperating would reduce the risk of forfeiting the next reward token to below 1%, then a utility-maximizing AI would always cooperate. What might go wrong with such an incentive scheme? One possibility is that the AI will not trust the human operator to deliver the promised rewards. The track record of human reliability is something other than a straight line of unerring perfection. The AI would reasonably worry that the operator will change his mind, or raise the performance bar, or fail to recognize that the AI has done its part. The AI would also worry about the operator becoming incapacitated. The combined risk of such failures might exceed the risk of attempting to seize control of the reward mechanism. Even a boxed AI, possessing the panoply of superpowers, is a strong force. For an AI that is not boxed to begin with, hijacking the human-governed reward mechanism may be like taking candy from a baby. Another problem with the incentive scheme is that it presupposes that we can tell whether the outcomes produced by the AI are in our interest. As later chapters will elaborate, this presupposition is not innocuous. A full assessment of the feasibility of incentive methods would also have to take into account a range of other factors, including some esoteric considerations that might conceivably make such methods more viable than a preliminary analysis would suggest. In particular, the AI may face ineliminable indexical uncertainty if it could not be sure that it does not inhabit a computer simulation, as opposed to basement-level, non-simulated physical reality. And this epistemic predicament may radically influence the AI's deliberations. See Box 8. Box 8. Anthropic capture. The AI might assign a substantial probability to its simulation hypothesis, the hypothesis that it is living in a computer simulation. Even today, many AIs inhabit simulated worlds, worlds consisting of geometric line drawings, texts, chess games, or simple virtual realities, and in which the laws of physics deviate sharply from the laws of physics that we believe govern the world of our own experience. Richer and more complicated virtual worlds will become feasible with improvements in programming techniques and computing power. A mature superintelligence could create virtual worlds that appear to its inhabitants much the same as our world appears to us. It might create vast numbers of such worlds, running the same simulation many times or with small variations. The inhabitants would not necessarily be able to tell whether their world is simulated or not, but if they are intelligent enough, they could consider the possibility and assign it some probability. In light of the simulation argument, a full discussion of which is beyond the scope of this book, that probability could be substantial. This predicament especially afflicts relatively early-stage superintelligences, ones that have not yet expanded to take advantage of the cosmic endowment. An early-stage superintelligence, which uses only a small fraction of the resources of a single planet, would be much less expensive to simulate than a mature intergalactic superintelligence. Potential simulators, that is, other more mature civilizations, would be able to run great numbers of simulations of such early-stage AIs, even by dedicating a minute fraction of their computational resources to that purpose. If at least some non-trivial fraction of these mature superintelligent civilizations choose to use this ability, early-stage AIs should assign a substantial probability to being in a simulation. How an AI would be affected by the simulation hypothesis depends on its values. Consider first an AI that has a resource-insatiable final goal, such as the goal of maximizing a utility function that is linear in the number of paperclips caused by the AI to exist. Twice as many paperclips, twice as good. Such an AI might care less about the simulation hypothesis on grounds that its ability to influence how many paperclips are produced looks much more limited if the AI is in a simulation than if it is in basement-level physical reality. The AI might accordingly behave much as if it were certain that the simulation hypothesis is false, even if it assigned a fairly high probability to the simulation hypothesis being true. The AI would reason that it does not much matter how it acts if the simulation hypothesis is true, whereas its actions make a great difference if the hypothesis is false. So it would select actions mainly by reference to how good they are, conditional on the simulation hypothesis being false. By contrast, consider an AI that has a more modest final goal, one that could be satisfied with a small amount of resources, such as the goal of receiving some pre-produced cryptographic reward tokens, or the goal of causing the existence of 45 virtual paperclips. Such an AI should not discount those possible worlds in which it inhabits a simulation. A substantial portion of the AI's total expected utility might derive from those possible worlds. The decision-making of an AI with goals that are easily resource-satiable may therefore, if it assigns a high probability to the simulation hypothesis, be dominated by considerations about which actions would produce the best result if its perceived world is a simulation. Such an AI, even if it is, in fact, not in a simulation, might therefore be heavily influenced by its beliefs about which behaviors would be rewarded in a simulation. In particular, if an AI with resource-satiable final goals believes that in most simulated worlds that match its observations, it will be rewarded if it cooperates, but not if it attempts to escape its box or contravene the interests of its creator, then it may choose to cooperate. We could therefore find that even an AI with a decisive strategic advantage, one that could in fact realize its final goals to a greater extent by taking over the world than by refraining from doing so, would nevertheless balk at doing so. Thus conscience does make cowards of us all, and thus the native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er with the pale cast of thought, and enterprises of great pith and moment, with this regard their currents turn away, and lose the name of action. Shakespeare, Hamlet, Act 3, Scene 1. A mere line in the sand, backed by the clout of a non-existent simulator, could prove a stronger restraint than a 2-foot-thick solid steel door. Stunting. Another possible capability control method is to limit the system's intellectual faculties or its access to information. This might be done by running the AI on hardware that is slow or short on memory. In the case of a boxed system, information inflow could also be restricted. Stunting an AI in these ways would limit its usefulness. The method thus faces a dilemma. Too little stunting, and the AI might have the wit to figure out some way to make itself more intelligent, and thence to world domination. too much, and the AI is just another piece of dumb software. A radically stunted AI is certainly safe, but does not solve the problem of how to achieve a controlled detonation. An intelligence explosion would remain possible, and would simply be triggered by some other system instead, perhaps at a slightly later date. One might think it would be safe to build a superintelligence, provided it is only given data about some narrow domain of facts. For example, one might build an AI that lacks sensors and that has preloaded into its memory only facts about petroleum engineering or peptide chemistry. But if the AI is superintelligent, if it has a superhuman level of general intelligence, such data deprivation does not guarantee safety. There are several reasons for this. First, the notion of information being about a certain topic is generally problematic. Any piece of information can, in principle, be relevant to any topic whatsoever, depending on the background information of a reasoner. Furthermore, a given data set contains information not only about the domain from which the data was collected, but also about various circumstantial facts. A shrewd mind looking over a knowledge base that is nominally about peptide chemistry might infer things about a wide range of topics. The fact that certain information is included and other information is not could tell an AI something about the state of human science, the methods and instruments available to study peptides, the fabrication technologies used to make these instruments, and the nature of the brains and societies that conceive the studies and the instruments. It might be that a superintelligence could correctly surmise a great deal from what seem, to dull-witted human minds, meager scraps of evidence. Even without any designated knowledge base at all, a sufficiently superior mind might be able to learn much by simply introspecting on the workings of its own psyche. The design choices reflected in its source code, the physical characteristics of its circuitry. Perhaps a superintelligence could even deduce much about the likely properties of the world a priori, combining logical inference with a probability prior bias towards simpler worlds, and a few elementary facts implied by the superintelligence existence as a reasoning system. It might imagine the consequences of different possible laws of physics. What kind of planets would form? What kind of intelligent life would evolve? What kind of societies would develop? What kind of methods to solve the control problem would be attempted? How those methods could be defeated? For these reasons, it would be imprudent to rely on information deprivation as the main check on a superintelligence's power. Some forms of stunting, however, including limiting hardware capacity and preventing the development of specific cognitive faculties, might find use as auxiliary control methods in the developmental phase. They could be used, for instance, to regulate the rate of capacity gain in an intermediary AI, and to allow tests to be run at different levels of capability, short of full-throttled superintelligence. Tripwires. A tripwire is a mechanism that performs diagnostic tests on the system, possibly without its knowledge, and effects a shutdown if it detects signs of dangerous activity. Programmers can then scrutinize recordings of the suspicious activity at their leisure, and make changes to the AI's codebase or environment before restarting it. If they find that the problem is sufficiently deep-rooted, they could decide to abort the entire project. Tripwires differ from incentive methods in that they do not rely on the system being aware of the consequences of engaging in forbidden activities. Tripwires are more closely related to stunting methods. Like stunting, tripwires could be used as a temporary safeguard, providing a degree of protection during the development phase. In principle, tripwires can also be used during the operational phase, particularly for a boxed system. However, the ability of tripwires to constrain a full-fledged superintelligence must remain very much in doubt, since it would be hard for us to assure ourselves that such an agent could not find ways to subvert any tripwire devised by the human intellect. As an adjunct safety measure in the development phase, though, tripwires are important. It would be good practice for the AI's designers to codify their expectations about how the system is supposed to function, and then to circumscribe the AI with tripwires that would be activated if any of these expectations is violated. To make the tests more stringent, honeypots could be strategically placed to create temptations for a malfunctioning AI to commit some easily observable violation. For instance, if an AI has been designed in such a way that it is supposed not to want to access the internet, a fake Ethernet port could be installed, leading to an automatic shutdown switch just to see if the AI tries to use it. Some examples of tripwires are given in Table 9. It should be emphasized that the value of a tripwire depends not only on the mechanism itself, but also, critically, on how a project reacts when a tripwire is triggered. If the programmers or project managers, impatient to make progress, simply switch the system back on again, or if they do so after making some token modification to prevent the tripwire being triggered on the next run, then no safety has been gained, even if the tripwire itself works exactly as intended. Motivation selection methods. Motivation selection methods seek to prevent undesirable outcomes by shaping what the superintelligence wants to do. By engineering the agent's motivation system and its final goals, these methods would produce a superintelligence that would not want to exploit a decisive strategic advantage in a harmful way. Since a superintelligent agent is skilled at achieving its ends, if it prefers not to cause harm, in some appropriate sense of harm, then it would tend not to cause harm, in that sense of harm. Motivation selection can involve explicitly formulating a goal or set of rules to be followed, direct specification, or setting up the system so that it can discover an appropriate set of values for itself by reference to some implicitly or indirectly formulated criterion, indirect normativity. One option in motivation selection is to try to build the system so that it would have modest, non-ambitious goals, domesticity. An alternative to creating a motivation system from scratch is to select an agent that already has an acceptable motivation system and then augment that agent's cognitive powers to make it super intelligent, while ensuring that the motivation system does not get corrupted in the process. Augmentation. Let us look at these in turn. Direct specification. Direct specification is the most straightforward approach to the control problem. The approach comes in two versions, rule-based and consequentialist, and involves trying to explicitly define a set of rules or values that will cause even a free-roaming superintelligent AI to act safely and beneficially. Direct specification, however, faces what may be insuperable obstacles, deriving from both the difficulties in determining which rules or values we would wish the AI to be guided by, and the difficulties in expressing those rules or values in computer-readable code. The traditional illustration of the direct, rule-based approach is the Three Laws of Robotics concept, formulated by science fiction author Isaac Asimov in a short story published in 1942. The three laws were: 1. A robot may not injure a human being, or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. 2. A robot must obey any orders given to it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. 3. A robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law. Embarrassingly for our species, Asimov's laws remain state-of-the-art for over half a century. This, despite obvious problems with the approach, some of which are explored in Asimov's own writings, Asimov probably having formulated the laws in the first place precisely so that they would fail in interesting ways, providing fertile plot complications for his stories. Bertrand Russell, who who spent many years working on the foundations of mathematics, once remarked that everything is vague to a degree you do not realize till you have tried to make it precise. Russell's dictum applies in spades to the direct specification approach. Consider, for example, how one might explicate Asimov's first law. Does it mean that the robot should minimize the probability of any human being coming to harm? In that case, the other laws become OTIOs, since it is always possible for the AI to take some action that would have at least some microscopic effect on the probability of a human being coming to harm. How is the robot to balance a large risk of a few humans coming to harm versus a small risk of many humans being harmed? How do we define harm anyway? How should the harm of physical pain be weighed against the harm of architectural ugliness or social injustice? Is a sadist harmed if he is prevented from tormenting his victim? How do we define human being? Why is no consideration given to other morally considerable beings, such as sentient non-human animals and digital minds? The more one ponders, the more the questions proliferate. Perhaps the closest existing analogue to a rule set that could govern the actions of a superintelligence operating in the world at large is a legal system. But legal systems have developed through a long process of trial and error, and they regulate relatively slowly changing human societies. Laws can be revised when necessary. Most importantly, legal systems are administered by judges and juries, who generally apply a measure of common sense and human decency to ignore logically possible legal interpretations that are sufficiently obviously unwanted and unintended by the lawgivers. It is probably humanly impossible to explicitly formulate a highly complex set of detailed rules, have them apply across a highly diverse set of circumstances, and get it right on the first implementation. Problems for the direct consequentialist approach are similar to those for the direct rule-based approach. This is true even if the AI is intended to serve some apparently simple purpose, such as implementing a version of classical utilitarianism. For instance, the goal, maximize the expectation of the balance of pleasure over pain in the world, may appear simple. Yet expressing it in computer code would involve, among other things, specifying how to recognize pleasure and pain. Doing this reliably might require solving an array of persistent problems in the philosophy of mind, even just to obtain a correct account expressed in a natural language, an account which would then, somehow, have to be translated into a programming language. A small error in either the philosophical account or its translation into code could have catastrophic consequences. Consider an AI that has hedonism as its final goal, and which would therefore like to tile the universe with hedonium, matter organized in a configuration that is optimal for the generation of pleasurable experience. To this end, the AI might produce computronium, matter organized in a configuration that is optimal for computation, and use it to implement digital minds in states of euphoria. In order to maximize efficiency, the AI omits from the implementation any mental faculties that are not essential for the experience of pleasure, and exploits any computational shortcuts that, according to its definition of pleasure, do not vitiate the generation of pleasure. For instance, the AI might confine its simulation to reward circuitry, eliding faculties such as memory, sensory perception, executive function, and language. It might simulate minds at a relatively coarse-grained level of functionality, omitting lower-level neuronal processes. It might replace commonly repeated computations with calls to a lookup table, or it might put in place some arrangement whereby multiple minds would share most parts of their underlying computational machinery, their supervenience bases, in philosophical parlance. Such tricks could greatly increase the quantity of pleasure producible with a given amount of resources. It is unclear how desirable this would be. Furthermore, if the AI's criterion for determining whether a physical process generates pleasure is wrong, then the AI's optimizations might throw the baby out with the bathwater. Discarding something which is inessential according to the AI's criterion, yet essential according to the criteria implicit in our human values. The universe then gets filled, not with exultingly heaving hedonium, but with computational processes that are unconscious and completely worthless. The equivalent of a smiley face sticker Xeroxed trillions upon trillions of times and plastered across the galaxies. Domesticity. One special type of final goal, which might be more amenable to direct specification than the examples given above, is the goal of self-limitation. While it seems extremely difficult to specify how one would want a superintelligence to behave in the world in general, since this would require us to account for all the trade-offs in all the situations that could arise, it might be feasible to specify how a superintelligence should behave in one particular situation. We could therefore seek to motivate the system to confine itself to acting on a small scale, within a narrow context, and through a limited set of action modes. We will refer to this approach of giving the AI final goals aimed at limiting the scope of its ambitions and activities as domesticity. For example, one could try to design an AI such that it would function as a question-answering device, an oracle, to anticipate the terminology that we will introduce in the next chapter. Simply giving the AI the final goal of producing maximally accurate answers to any question posed to it would be unsafe. Recall the Riemann hypothesis catastrophe described in Chapter 8. Reflect also that this goal would incentivize the AI to take actions to ensure that it is asked easy questions. To achieve domesticity, one might try to define a final goal that would somehow overcome these difficulties. Perhaps a goal that combined the desiderata of answering questions correctly and minimizing the AI's impact on the world, except whatever impact results as an incidental consequence of giving accurate and non-manipulative answers to the questions it is asked. The direct specification of such a domesticity goal is more likely to be feasible than the direct specification of either a more ambitious goal or a complete rule set for operating in an open-ended range of situations. Significant challenges nonetheless remain. Care would have to be taken, for instance, in the definition of what it would be for the AI to minimize its impact on the world, to ensure that the measure of the AI's impact coincides with our own standards for what counts as a large or a small impact. A bad measure would lead to bad trade-offs. There are also other kinds of risk associated with building an oracle, which we will discuss later. There is a natural fit between the domesticity approach and physical containment. One would try to box an AI such that the system is unable to escape, while simultaneously trying to shape the AI's motivation system such that it would be unwilling to escape, even if it found a way to do so. Other things equal, the existence of multiple independent safety mechanisms should shorten the odds of success. Indirect normativity. If direct specification seems hopeless, we might instead try indirect normativity. The basic idea is that rather than specifying a concrete normative standard directly, we specify a process for deriving a standard. We then build the system so that it is motivated to carry out this process and to adopt whatever standard the process arrives at. For example, the process could be to carry out an investigation into the empirical question of what some suitably idealized version of us would prefer the AI to do. The final goal given to the AI in this example could be something along the lines of achieve that which we would have wished the AI to achieve if we had thought about the matter long and hard. Further explanation of indirect normativity will have to await Chapter 13. There, we will revisit the idea of extrapolating our volition, and explore various alternative formulations. Indirect normativity is a very important approach to motivation selection. Its promise lies in the fact that it could let us offload to the superintelligence much of the difficult cognitive work required to carry out a direct specification of an appropriate final goal. Augmentation. The last motivation selection method on our list is augmentation. Here the idea is that rather than attempting to design a motivation system de novo, we start with a system that already has an acceptable motivation system and enhance its cognitive faculties to make it superintelligent. If all goes well, this would give us a superintelligence with an acceptable motivation system. This approach, obviously, is unavailing in the case of a newly created seed AI. But augmentation is a potential motivation selection method for other paths to superintelligence, including brain emulation, biological enhancement, brain-computer interfaces, and networks and organizations, where there is a possibility of building out the system from a normative nucleus, regular human beings, that already contains a representation of human value. The attractiveness of augmentation may increase in proportion to our despair at the other approaches to the control problem. Creating a motivation system for a seed AI that remains reliably safe and beneficial under recursive self-improvement, even as the system grows into a mature superintelligence, is a tall order, especially if we must get the solution right on the first attempt. With augmentation, we would at least start with a system that has familiar and human-like motivations. On the downside, it might be hard to ensure that a complex, evolved, kludgy, and poorly understood motivation system, like that of a human being, will not get corrupted when its cognitive engine blasts into the stratosphere. As discussed earlier, an imperfect brain emulation procedure that preserves intellectual functioning may not preserve all facets of personality. The same is true, though perhaps to a lesser degree, for biological enhancements of cognition, which might subtly affect motivation, and for collective intelligence enhancements of organizations and networks, which might adversely change social dynamics, e.g., in ways that debase the collective's attitude toward outsiders or toward its own constituents. If superintelligence is achieved via any of these paths, a project sponsor would find guarantees about the ultimate motivations of the mature system hard to come by. A mathematically well-specified and foundationally elegant AI architecture might, for all its non-anthropomorphic otherness, offer greater transparency, perhaps even the prospect that important aspects of its functionality could be formally verified. In the end, however one tallies up the advantages and disadvantages of augmentation, the choice as to whether to rely on it might be forced. If superintelligence is first achieved along the artificial intelligence path, augmentation is not applicable. Conversely, if superintelligence is first achieved along some non-AI path, then many of the other motivation selection methods are inapplicable. Even so, views on how likely augmentation would be to succeed do have strategic relevance insofar as we have opportunities to influence which technology will first produce superintelligence. Synopsis. A quick synopsis might be called for before we close this chapter. We distinguish two broad classes of methods for dealing with the agency problem at the heart of AI safety: capability control and motivation selection. Table 10 gives a summary. Each control method comes with potential vulnerabilities and presents different degrees of difficulty in its implementation. It might perhaps be thought that we should rank them from better to worse, and then opt for the best method. But that would be simplistic. Some methods can be used in combination, whereas others are exclusive. Even a comparatively insecure method may be advisable if it can easily be used as an adjunct, whereas a strong method might be unattractive if it would preclude the use of other desirable safeguards. It is therefore necessary to consider what package deals are available. we need to consider what type of system we might try to build, and which control methods would be applicable to each type. This is the topic for our next chapter. Chapter 10. Oracles, Genies, Sovereigns, Tools. Some say, just build a question-answering system, or just build an AI that is like a tool rather than an agent. But these suggestions do not make all safety concerns go away, and it is in fact a non-trivial question which type of system would offer the best prospects for safety. We consider four types, or castes: oracles, genies, sovereigns, and tools, and explain how they relate to one another. Each offers different sets of advantages and disadvantages in our quest to solve the control problem. Oracles. An oracle is a question-answering system. It might accept questions in a natural language and present its answers as text. An oracle that accepts only yes-no questions could output its best guess with a single bit, or perhaps with a few extra bits to represent its degree of confidence. An oracle that accepts open-ended questions would need some metric with which to rank possible truthful answers in terms of their informativeness or appropriateness. In either case, building an oracle that has a fully domain-general ability to answer natural language questions is an AI-complete problem. If one could do that, one could probably also build an AI that has a decent ability to understand human intentions as well as human words. Oracles with domain-limited forms of superintelligence are also conceivable. For instance, one could conceive of a mathematics oracle which would only accept queries posed in a formal language, but which would be very good at answering such questions, e.g., being able to solve in an instant almost any formally expressed math problem that the human mathematics profession could solve by laboring collaboratively for a century. Such a mathematics oracle would form a stepping stone toward domain general superintelligence. Oracles with superintelligence in extremely limited domains already exist. A pocket calculator can be viewed as a very narrow oracle for basic arithmetical questions. An internet search engine can be viewed as a very partial realization of an oracle with a domain that encompasses a significant part of general human declarative knowledge. These domain-limited oracles are tools rather than agents. More on tool AI shortly. In what follows, though, the term oracle will refer to question-answering systems that have domain-general superintelligence, unless otherwise stated. To make a general superintelligence function as an oracle, we could apply both motivation selection and capability control. Motivation selection for an oracle may be easier than for other castes of superintelligence, because the final goal in an oracle could be comparatively simple. We would want the oracle to give truthful, non-manipulative answers and to otherwise limit its impact on the world. Applying a domesticity method, we might require that the oracle should use only designated resources to produce its answer. For example, we might stipulate that it should base its answer on a preloaded corpus of information, such as a stored snapshot of the internet, and that it should use no more than a fixed number of computational steps. To avoid incentivizing the oracle to manipulate us into giving it easier questions, which would happen if we gave it the goal of maximizing its accuracy across all questions we will ask it, we could give it the goal of answering only one question and to terminate immediately upon delivering its answer. The question would be preloaded into its memory before the program is run. To ask a second question, we would reset the machine and run the same program with a different question preloaded in memory. Subtle and potentially treacherous challenges arise even in specifying the relatively simple motivation system needed to drive an oracle. Suppose, for example, that we come up with some explication of what it means for the AI to minimize its impact on the world, subject to achieving certain results, or to use only designated resources in preparing the answer. What happens if the AI, in the course of its intellectual development, undergoes the equivalent of a scientific revolution involving a change in its basic ontology? We might initially have explicated impact and designated resources using our own ontology, postulating the existence of various physical objects such as computers. But just as we have abandoned ontological categories that were taken for granted by scientists in previous ages, e.g. phlogiston, élan vital, and absolute simultaneity, so a superintelligent AI might discover that some of our current categories are predicated on fundamental misconceptions. The goal system of an AI undergoing an ontological crisis needs to be resilient enough that the spirit of its original goal content is carried over, charitably transposed into the new key. Although making an oracle safe through the use of motivation selection might be far from trivial, it may nevertheless be easier than doing the same for an AI that roams the world in pursuit of some complicated goal. This is an argument for preferring that the first superintelligence be an oracle. Another point in favor of an oracle-first path is the greater susceptibility of an oracle to capability control. All the standard boxing methods apply here. In addition, there may be methods that are distinctively applicable to oracles. For example, consider the risk that an oracle will answer questions not in a maximally truthful way, but in such a way as to subtly manipulate us into promoting its own hidden agenda. One way to slightly mitigate this threat could be to create multiple oracles, each with a slightly different code and a slightly different information base. A simple mechanism could then compare the answers given by the different oracles and only present them for human viewing if all the answers agree. While one must assume that any superintelligent domain general oracle would know about the existence of other oracles, it could infer this from its knowledge about human society. It might be feasible to hide some implementation details of each oracle from the views of the others. If the oracles are not able to communicate with one another, it might then be difficult for them to coordinate on how to answer our questions manipulatively. There are many ways of deviating from the truth, and the oracles may not all agree on which of these deviations is most attractive, whereas the truth itself is a shelling point, a salient place for agreement in the absence of communication. So, if the oracles achieve consensus, it might be a sign that they gave the true answer. An oracle would ideally be trustworthy in the sense that we could safely assume that its answers are always accurate to the best of its ability. But even an untrustworthy oracle could be useful. We could ask such an oracle questions of a type for which it is difficult to find the answer, but easy to verify whether a given answer is correct. Many mathematical problems are of this kind. If we are wondering whether a mathematical proposition is true, we could ask the oracle to produce a proof or disproof of the proposition. Finding the proof may require insight and creativity beyond our ken, but checking a purported proof's validity can be done by a simple mechanical procedure. If it is expensive to verify answers, as is often the case on topics outside logic and mathematics, we can randomly select a subset of the oracle's answers for verification. If they are all correct, we can assign a high probability to most of the other answers also being correct. This trick can give us a bulk discount on trustworthy answers that would be costly to verify individually. Unfortunately, it cannot give us trustworthy answers that we are unable to verify, since a dissembling oracle may choose to answer correctly only those questions where it believes we could verify its answers. There could be important issues on which we could benefit from an augural pointer toward the correct answer, or toward a method for locating the correct answer, even if we had to actively distrust the provenance. For instance, one might ask for the solution to various technical or philosophical problems that may arise in the course of trying to develop more advanced motivation selection methods. If we had a proposed AI design alleged to be safe, We could ask an oracle whether it could identify any significant flaw in the design, and whether it could explain any such flaw to us in 20 words or less. Questions of this kind